are part of the goods men possess and a means of exchange among themselves. The mistake comes from confusing two forms of mutually exclusive alterity. Insofar as woman is considered the absolute other, that is, whatever magic powers she has, as the inessential, it is precisely impossible to regard her as another subject. Note: it will be seen that this distinction has been perpetuated. Periods that regard woman as other are those that refuse most harshly to integrate her into society as a human being. Today, she only becomes an other peer by losing her mystical aura. Anti-feminists have always played on this ambiguity. They readily agree to exalt the woman as other in order to make her alterity absolute and irreducible, and to refuse her access to the human mitzvah. Women have thus never constituted a separate group that posited itself for itself before a male group. They have never had a direct or autonomous relationship with men. The relationship of reciprocity, which is the basis of marriage, is not established between men and women, but between men by means of women, who are merely the occasion of this relationship, said Levi Strauss. Note: Levi Strauss, The Elementary Structures of Kinship. Woman's concrete condition is not affected by the type of lineage that prevails in the society to which she belongs. Whether the regime is patrilineal, matrilineal, bilateral, or undifferentiated, undifferentiation never being precise, she is always under men's guardianship. The only question is if, after marriage, she is still subjected to the authority of her father or her oldest brother, authority that will also extend to her children, or of her husband. In any case, the woman is never anything more than the symbol of her lineage. Matrilineal descent is the authority of the woman's father or brother extended to the brother-in-law's village. She only mediates the law. She does not possess it. In fact, it is the relationship of two masculine groups that is defined by the system of filiation, and not the relation of the two sexes. In practice, woman's concrete condition is not consistently linked to any given type of law. It may happen that in a matrilineal system, she has a very high position, but beware, the presence of a woman chief or a queen at the head of a tribe absolutely does not mean that women are sovereign. The reign of Catherine the Great changed nothing in the fate of Russian peasant women, and they lived no less frequently in a state of abjection. And cases where a woman remains in her clan and her husband makes rapid, even clandestine visits to her are very rare. She almost always goes to live under her husband's roof. This fact is proof enough of male domination. Behind the variations in the type of descent, writes Levi Strauss, the permanence of patrilocal residence attests to the basic asymmetrical relationship between the sexes, which is characteristic of human society. Since she keeps her children with her, the result is that the territorial organization of the tribe does not correspond to its totemic organization. The former is contingent, the latter rigorously constructed. But in practice, the first was the more important because the place where people work and live counts more than their mystical connection. In the more widespread transitional regimes, there are two kinds of rights, one based on religion and the other on the occupation and labor on the land, and they overlap. Though only a secular institution, marriage nevertheless has great social importance, and the conjugal family, though stripped of religious signification, is very alive on a human level. Even within groups where great sexual freedom is found, it is considered conventional for a woman who brings a child into the world to be married. Alone with an offspring, she cannot constitute an autonomous group, and her brother's religious protection does not suffice. A husband's presence is required. He often has many heavy responsibilities for the children. They do not belong to his clan, but it is nonetheless he who feeds and raises them. Between husband and wife and father and son, bonds of cohabitation, work, common interest, and tenderness are formed. Relations between this secular family and the totemic clan are extremely complex, as the diversity of marriage rites attests. In primitive times, a husband buys a wife from a foreign clan, or at least there is an exchange of goods from one clan to another, the first giving over one of its members and the second delivering cattle, fruits, or work in return. But as husbands take charge of wives and their children, it also happens that they receive remuneration from their bride's brothers. The balance between mystical and economic realities is an unstable one. Men often have a closer attachment to their sons than to their nephews. It is as a father that a man will choose to affirm himself when such affirmation becomes possible. And this is why every society tends toward a patriarchal form as its development leads man to gain awareness of himself and to impose his will. But it is important to emphasize that even at times when he was still confused by the mysteries of life, nature, and woman, he never relinquished his power. When, terrified by the dangerous magic woman possesses, he posits her as the essential, it is he who posits her, and he who realizes himself thereby as the essential in this alienation he grants. In spite of the fecund virtues that infuse her, man remains her master, just as he is master of the fertile earth. She is destined to be subordinated, possessed, and exploited, as is also nature, whose magic fertility she incarnates. The prestige she enjoys in the eyes of men comes from them. They kneel before the other. They worship the goddess mother. But as powerful as she may appear, she is defined through notions created by the male consciousness. All of the idols invented by man, however terrifying he may have made them, are in fact dependent upon him. And this is why he is able to destroy them. In primitive societies, this dependence is not acknowledged and posited, but its existence is implicit in itself, and it will readily become mediatory as soon as man develops a clearer consciousness of self, as soon as he dares to assert himself and stand in opposition. And in fact, even when man grasps himself as given, passive, and subject to the vagaries of rain and sun, he still realizes himself as transcendence, as project. Already, spirit and will assert themselves within him against life's confusion and contingencies. The totem ancestor of which woman assumes multiple incarnations is more or less distinctly a male principle under its animal or tree name. Woman perpetuates carnal existence, but her role is only that of nourisher, not of creator. In no domain whatsoever does she create. She maintains the life of the tribe by providing children and bread, nothing more. She lives condemned to immanence. She incarnates only the static aspect of society, closed in on itself. Meanwhile, man continues to monopolize the functions that open this society to nature and to the whole of humanity. The only efforts worthy of him are war, hunting, and fishing. He conquers foreign prey and annexes it to the tribe. War, hunting, and fishing represent an expansion of existence. His going beyond into the world, the male is still the only incarnation of transcendence. He does not yet have the practical means to totally dominate woman Earth. He does not yet dare stand up to her, but already he wants to tear himself away from her. I think the profound reason for the well-known custom of exogamy so widespread in matrilineal societies is to be found in this determination. Even though man is unaware of the role he plays in procreation, marriage has great importance for him. This is where he attains adult dignity and receives his share of a piece of the world. Through his mother, he is bound to the clan, his ancestors, and everything that constitutes his own subsistence. But in all of these secular functions, work or marriage, he aspires to escape this circle and assert transcendence against immanence, to open up a future different from the past where he is rooted. Depending on the types of relations recognized in different societies, the banning of incest takes on different forms. But from primitive times to our days, it has remained the same. Man wishes to possess that which he is not. He unites himself to what appears to him to be other than himself. The wife must not be part of the husband's mana. She must be foreign to him, thus foreign to his clan. Primitive marriage is sometimes founded on abduction, real or symbolic, because violence done to another is the clearest affirmation of another's alterity. Taking his wife by force, the warrior proves he is able to annex the riches of others and burst through the bounds of the destiny assigned to him at birth, purchasing her under various forms, paying tribute, rendering services, has, less dramatically, the same signification. Note, in Levi Strauss's thesis already cited, there is, in a slightly different form, a confirmation of this idea. What comes out of this study is that the prohibition of incest is in no way the primal factor underlying exogamy, but it reflects the positive desire for exogamy in a negative form. There is no intrinsic reason that it be improper for a woman to have intercourse with men in her clan, but it is socially useful that she be part of the goods by which each clan, instead of closing in on itself, establishes a reciprocal relationship with another clan. Exogamy has a value less negative than positive. It prohibits endogamous marriage. Certainly not because a biological danger is attached to consanguineous marriage, but because exogamous marriage results in a social benefit. The group should not, for its own private purposes, consume women who constitute one of its possessions, but should use them as an instrument of communication. If marriage with a woman of the same clan is forbidden, the sole reason is that she is same, whereas she must, and therefore can, become other. The same women that were originally offered can be exchanged in return. All that is necessary on either side is the sign of otherness, which is the outcome of a certain position in a structure and not of any innate characteristic. Little by little, man mediated his experience, and in his representations, as in his practical existence, the male principle triumphed. Spirit prevailed over life, transcendence over immanence, technology over magic, and reason over superstition. The devaluation of woman represents a necessary stage in the history of humanity, for she derived her prestige not from her positive value, but from man's weakness. She incarnated disturbing natural mysteries. Man escapes her grasp when he frees himself from nature. In passing from stone to bronze, he is able to conquer the land through his work and conquer himself as well. The farmer is subjected to the vagaries of the soil, of germination, and of seasons. He is passive, he beseeches, and he waits. This explains why totem spirits peopled the human world. The peasant endured the whims of these forces that took possession of him. On the contrary, the worker fashions a tool according to his own design. He imposes on it the form that fits his project, facing an inert nature that defies him, but that he overcomes. He asserts himself as sovereign will. If he quickens his strokes on the anvil, he quickens the completion of the tool, whereas nothing can hasten the ripening of grain. His responsibility develops with what he makes. His movement, adroit or maladroit, makes it or breaks it. Careful, skillful, he brings it to a point of perfection he can be proud of. His success depends not on the favor of the gods, but on himself. He challenges his fellow workers. He takes pride in his success, and while he still leaves some place for rituals, applied techniques seem far more important to him. Mystical values become secondary, and practical interests take precedence. He is not entirely liberated from the gods, but he distances himself by distancing them from himself. He relegates them to their Olympian heaven and keeps the terrestrial domain for himself. The great Pan begins to fade at the first sound of his hammer, and man's reign begins. He discovers his power. He finds cause and effect in the relationship between his creating arm and the object of his creation. The seed planted germinates or not, while metal always reacts in the same way to fire, to tempering, and to mechanical treatment. This world of tools can be framed in clear concepts. Rational thinking, logic, and mathematics are thus able to emerge. The whole representation of the universe is overturned. Woman's religion is bound to the reign of agriculture, a reign of irreducible duration, contingencies, chance, anticipation, and mystery, the reign of Homo Faber, is the reign of time that can be conquered like space, the reign of necessity, project, action, and reason. Even when he contends with the earth, he will henceforth contend with it as a worker. He discovers that the soil can be fertilized, that it is good to let it lie fallow, that certain seeds should be treated certain ways. It is he who makes the crops grow. He digs canals. He irrigates or drains the land. He lays out roads. He builds temples. He creates the world anew. The peoples who remained under the heel of the mother goddess where matrilineal filiation was perpetuated were also those arrested in a primitive state of civilization. Woman was venerated only in as much as man was a slave to his own fears, a party to his own impotence. It was out of fear and not love that he worshipped her. Before he could accomplish himself, he had to begin by dethroning her. Note: of course, this condition is necessary, but not sufficient. There are patrilineal civilizations immobilized in a primitive stage. Others, like the Mayas, regressed. There is no absolute hierarchy between societies of maternal right and those of paternal right, but only the latter have evolved technically and ideologically. It is the male principle of creative force, light, intelligence, and order that he will henceforth recognize as a sovereign. Standing beside the mother goddess emerges a god, a son, or a lover, who is still inferior to her, but who looks exactly like her, and who is associated with her. He also incarnates the fertility principle. He is a bull, the Minotaur, or the Nile, fertilizing the plains of Egypt. He dies in autumn and is reborn in spring, after the spouse mother, invulnerable yet tearful, has devoted her forces to searching for his body and bringing him back to life. Appearing in Crete, this couple can also be found all along the banks of the Mediterranean. Isis and Horus in Egypt, Astarte and Adonis in Phoenicia, Cybele and Attis in Asia Minor, and Rhea and Zeus in Hellenic Greece. And then the Great Mother was dethroned. In Egypt, where woman's condition is exceptionally favorable, the goddess Nut, incarnating the sky, and Isis, the fertile land, wife of the Nile, Osiris, continue to be extremely important. But it is nonetheless Ra, the sun god, virile light and energy, who is the supreme king. In Babylon, Ishtar is only the wife of Belmarduk, and it is he who created things and guaranteed harmony. The god of the Semites is male. When Zeus reigns in heaven, Gia, Rhea, and Cybele have to abdicate. All that is left to Demeter is a still imposing but secondary divinity. The Vedic gods have wives, but these are not worshipped as they are. The Roman Jupiter has no equal. Note: it is interesting to note, according to H. Beguin, Journal of Psychology, 1934, that in the Aurignacian period, there were numerous statuettes representing women with overly emphasized sexual attributes. They are noteworthy for their plumpness and the size accorded to their vulvas. Moreover, grossly sketched vulvas on their own were also found in caves. In the Solutrean and Magdalenian epics, these effigies disappear. In the Aurignacian, masculine statuettes are very rare, and there are never any representations of the male organ. In the Magdalenian epic, some representations of vulvas are still found, though in small quantities, but a great quantity of phalluses was discovered. Thus, the triumph of patriarchy was neither an accident nor the result of a violent revolution. From the origins of humanity, their biological privilege enabled men to affirm themselves alone as sovereign subjects. They never abdicated this privilege. They alienated part of their existence in nature and in woman, but they won it back afterward. Condemned to play the role of the other, woman was thus condemned to possess no more than precarious power. Slave or idol, she was never the one who chose her lot. "Men make gods and women worship them," said Fraser. "It is men who decide if their supreme divinities will be females or males. The place of woman in society is always the one they assign her. At no time has she imposed her own law." Perhaps, however, if productive work had remained at the level of her strength, woman would have achieved the conquest of nature with man. The human species affirmed itself against the gods through male and female individuals, but she could not obtain the benefits of tools for herself. Engels only incompletely explained her decline. It is insufficient to say that the invention of bronze and iron profoundly modified the balance of productive forces and brought about women's inferiority. This inferiority is not in itself sufficient to account for the oppression she has suffered. What was harmful for her was that, not becoming a labor partner for the worker, she was excluded from the human mitzvah. That woman is weak and has a lower productive capacity does not explain this exclusion. Rather, it is because she did not participate in his way of working and thinking, and because she remained enslaved to the mysteries of life, that the male did not recognize in her an equal. By not accepting her, once she kept in his eyes the dimension of other, man could only become her oppressor. The male will for expansion and domination transformed feminine incapacity into a curse. Man wanted to exhaust the new possibilities opened up by new technology. He called upon a servile workforce, and he reduced his fellow man to slavery. Slave labor being far more efficient than work that woman could supply, she lost the economic role she played within the tribe, and in this relationship with the slave, the master found a far more radical confirmation of his sovereignty than the tempered authority he exercised on woman. Venerated and revered for her fertility, being other than man, and sharing the disquieting character of the other, woman, in a certain way, kept man dependent on her even while she was dependent on him. The reciprocity of the master-slave relationship existed in the present for her, and it was how she escaped slavery. As for the slave, he had no taboo to protect him, being nothing but a servile man, not just different, but inferior. The dialectic of the slave-master relationship will take centuries to be actualized. Within the organized patriarchal society, the slave is only a beast of burden with a human face. The master exercises tyrannical authority over him. This exalts his pride, and he turns it against the woman. Everything he wins against her. The more powerful he becomes, the more she declines. In particular, when he acquires ownership of land, he also claims woman as property. Note, refer to Part 1, Chapter 3 in this volume. Formerly he was possessed by the manna, by the earth. Now he has a soul, property. Freed from woman, he now lays claim to a woman and a posterity of his own. He wants the family labor he uses for the benefit of his fields to be totally his, and for this to happen, the workers must belong to him. He subjugates his wife and his children. He must have heirs who will extend his life on earth because he bequeaths them his possessions, and who will give him in turn, beyond the tomb, the necessary honors for the repose of his soul. The cult of the domestic gods is superimposed on the constitution of private property, and the function of heirs is both economic and mystical. Thus, the day agriculture ceases to be an essentially magic operation and becomes creative labor, man finds himself to be a generative force. He lays claim to his children and his crops at the same time. Note, in the same way that woman was identified with furrows, the phallus was identified with the plow and vice versa. In a drawing representing a plow from the Kassite period, there are traces of the symbols of the generative act. Afterward, the phallus-plow identity was frequently reproduced in art forms. The word lock in some Austro-Asian languages designates both phallus and plow. An Assyrian prayer addresses a god whose plow fertilized the earth. There is no ideological revolution more important in the primitive period than the one replacing matrilineal descent with egnation. From that time on, the mother is lowered to the rank of wet nurse or servant, and the father's sovereignty is exalted. He is the one who holds rites and transmits them. Apollo, in Aeschylus's Eumenides, proclaims these new truths. The mother is no parent of that which is called her child, but only nurse of the new planted seed that grows. The parent is he who mounts. A stranger, she preserves a stranger's seed, if no God interfere. It is clear that these affirmations are not the results of scientific discoveries. They are acts of faith. Undoubtedly, the experience of technical cause and effect, from which man draws the assurance of his creative powers, makes him recognize he is as necessary to procreation as the mother. Idea-guided observation. But the latter is restricted to granting the father a role equal to that of the mother. It led to the supposition that, as for nature, the condition for conception was the encounter of sperm and menses. Aristotle's idea that woman is merely matter and the principle of movement, which is male in all living beings, is better and more divine, is an idea that expresses a will to power that goes beyond all of what is known. In attributing his posterity exclusively to himself, man frees himself definitively from subjugation by women, and he triumphs over woman in the domination of the world. Doomed to procreation and secondary tasks, stripped of her practical importance and her mystical prestige, woman becomes no more than a servant. Men represented this triumph as the outcome of a violent struggle. One of the most ancient cosmologies belonging to the Assyro-Babylonians tells of their victory in a text that dates from the 7th century, but that recounts an even older legend. The sun and the sea, Aten and Tiamat, gave birth to the celestial world, the terrestrial world, and the great gods, but finding them too turbulent, they decided to destroy them. And Tiamat, the woman mother, led the struggle against the strongest and most fine-looking of her descendants, Belmarduk. He, having challenged her in combat, killed her and slashed her body in two after a frightful battle. With one half he made the vault of heaven, and with the other, the foundation for the terrestrial world. Then he gave order to the universe and created humanity. In the Eumenides drama, which illustrated the triumph of patriarchy over maternal right, Orestes also assassinates Clytemnestra. Through these bloody victories, the virile force and the solar forces of order and light win over feminine chaos. By absolving Orestes, the tribunal of the gods proclaims he is the son of Agamemnon, before being the son of Clytemnestra. The old maternal right is dead. The audacious male revolt killed it. But we have seen that in reality, the passage to paternal rights took place through gradual transitions. Masculine conquest was a reconquest. Man only took possession of that which he already possessed. He put law into harmony with reality. There was neither struggle nor victory nor defeat. Nevertheless, these legends have profound meaning. At the moment when man asserts himself as subject and freedom, the idea of the other becomes mediatory. From this day on, the relationship with the other is a drama. The existence of the other is a threat and a danger. The ancient Greek philosophy, which Plato, on this point, does not deny, showed that alterity is the same as negation, thus evil. To posit the other is to define Manichaeism. This is why religions and their codes treat woman with such hostility. By the time humankind reaches the stage of writing its mythology and laws, patriarchy is definitively established. It is males who write the codes. It is natural for them to give woman a subordinate situation. One might imagine, however, that they would consider her with the same benevolence as children and animals. But no. Afraid of woman, legislators organize her oppression. Only the harmful aspects of the ambivalent virtues attributed to her are retained. From sacred, she becomes unclean. Eve, given to Adam to be his companion, lost humankind. To punish men, the pagan gods invent women. And Pandora, the firstborn of these female creatures, is the one who unleashes all the evil that humanity endures. The other is passivity confronting activity, diversity breaking down unity, matter opposing form, disorder resisting order. Woman is thus doomed to evil. There is a good principle that created order, light, and man, and a bad principle that created chaos, darkness, and woman, says Pythagoras. The laws of Manu define her as a vile being to be held in slavery. Leviticus assimilates her to beasts of burden owned by the patriarch. The laws of Solon confer no rights on her. The Roman code puts her in guardianship and proclaims her imbecility. Canon law considers her the devil's gateway. The Quran treats her with the most absolute contempt. And yet evil needs good, matter needs the idea, and night needs light. Man knows that to satisfy his desires, to perpetuate his existence, woman is indispensable to him. He has to integrate her in society. As long as she submits to the order established by males, she is cleansed of her original stain. This idea is forcefully expressed in the laws of Manu. Whatever be the qualities of the man with whom a woman is united according to the law, such qualities even she assumes, like a river united with the ocean, and she is admitted after death to the same celestial paradise. The Bible, too, praises the virtuous woman. Christianity, in spite of its loathing of the flesh, respects the devoted virgin and the chaste and docile wife. Within a religious group, woman can even hold an important religious position. Brahmani in India and Flaminica in Rome are as holy as their husbands. In a couple, the man is dominant, but both male and female principles remain essential to the childbearing function, to life, and to the social order. This very ambivalence of the other, of the female, will be reflected in the rest of her history. Until our times, she will be subordinated to men's will. But this will is ambiguous. By total annexation, woman will be lowered to the rank of a thing. Of course, man attempts to cover with his own dignity what he conquers and possesses. In his eyes, the other retains some of her primitive magic. One of the problems he will seek to solve is how to make his wife both a servant and a companion. His attitude will evolve throughout the centuries, and this will also entail an evolution in woman's destiny. Note: we will examine this evolution in the Western world. The history of the woman in the East, in India, and in China was one of long and immutable slavery. From the Middle Ages to today, we will center this study on France, where the situation is typical. Chapter 3. Once woman is dethroned by the advent of private property, her fate is linked to it for centuries. In large part, her history is intertwined with the history of inheritance. The fundamental importance of this institution becomes clear if we keep in mind that the owner alienated his existence in property. It was more important to him than life itself. It goes beyond the strict limits of a mortal lifetime. It lives on after the body is gone, an earthly and tangible incarnation of the immortal soul. But this continued survival can occur only if property remains in the owner's hands. It can remain his after death only if it belongs to individuals who are extensions of himself and recognized, who are his own. Cultivating paternal lands and worshiping the father spirit are one and the same obligation for the heir, to ensure the survival of ancestors on earth and in the underworld. Man will not, therefore, agree to share his property or his children with woman. He will never really be able to go that far. But at a time when patriarchy is powerful, he strips woman of all her rights to hold and transmit property. It seems logical, in fact, to deny her these rights. If it is accepted that a woman's children do not belong to her, they inevitably have no link with the group the woman comes from. Woman is no longer passed from one clan to another through marriage. She is radically abducted from the group she is born into and annexed to her husband's. He buys her like a head of cattle or a slave. He imposes his domestic divinities on her, and the children she conceives belong to her spouse's family. If she could inherit, she would thus wrongly transmit her paternal family's riches to that of her husband. She is carefully excluded from the succession. But inversely, because she owns nothing, woman is not raised to the dignity of a person. She herself is part of man's patrimony. First, her father's, and then her husband's. under a strictly patriarchal regime, a father can condemn to death his male and female children at birth. But in the case of a male child, society most often put limits on this power. A normally constituted newborn male is allowed to live, whereas the custom of exposure is very widespread for girls. There was massive infanticide among Arabs. As soon as they were born, girls were thrown into ditches. Accepting a female child is an act of generosity on the father's part. The woman enters such societies only through a kind of grace bestowed on her, and not legitimately like males. In any case, the stain of birth is far more serious for the mother when a girl is born. Among Hebrews, Leviticus demands twice as much cleansing as for a newborn boy. In societies where blood money exists, only a small sum is required when the victim is of the feminine sex. Her value, compared with a male's, is like a slave's with a free man's. When she is a young girl, the father has total power over her. On her marriage, he transmits it entirely to her spouse. Since she is his property, like the slave, the beast of burden, or the thing, it is natural for a man to have as many wives as he wishes. Only economic reasons put limits on polygamy. The husband can disown his wives at whim, and society barely accords them any guarantees. In return, woman is subjected to rigorous chastity. In spite of the taboos, matriarchal societies allow great freedom of behavior. Prenuptial chastity is rarely demanded, and adultery not judged severely. On the contrary, when woman becomes man's property, he wants a virgin, and he demands total fidelity at the risk of severe penalty. It would be the worst of crimes to risk giving heritage rights to a foreign offspring. This is why the paterfamilias has the right to put a guilty wife to death. As long as private property lasts, conjugal infidelity on the part of a woman is considered a crime of high treason. All codes up to our time have perpetuated inequality in issues concerning adultery, arguing the seriousness of the fault committed by the woman who might bring an illegitimate child into the family. And though the right to take the law into one's own hands has been abolished since Augustus, the Napoleonic Code still holds out the promise of the jury's leniency for a husband who avenges himself. When woman belonged to both a patrilineal clan and a conjugal family, she was able to preserve a good amount of freedom. As the two series of bonds overlapped and even conflicted with each other, and as each system served to support her against the other. For example, she could often choose the husband of her fancy, since marriage was only a secular event and had no effect on society's deep structure. But under the patriarchal regime, she was the property of a father who married her off as he saw fit. Then, attached to her husband's household, she was no more than his thing, and the thing of the family, genos, in which she was placed. When family and private patrimony incontestably remain the bases of society, woman also remains totally alienated. This is what has happened in the Muslim world. The structure is feudal in that there has never been a state strong enough to unify and dominate the numerous tribes. No power holds in check that of the patriarch chief. The religion that was created when the Arab people were warriors and conquerors professed the utmost disdain toward women. Men are superior to women on account of the qualities with which God has gifted the one above the other, and on account of the outlay they make from their substance for them, says the Quran. The woman has never held real power or mystic prestige. The Bedouin woman works hard. She plows and carries burdens. This is how she sets up a reciprocal bond with her husband. She moves around freely, her face uncovered. The Muslim woman, veiled and shut in, is still today a kind of slave in most levels of society. I recall an underground cave in a troglodyte village in Tunisia where four women were squatting. The old, one-eyed and toothless wife, her face ravaged, was cooking dough on a small brazier surrounded by acrid smoke. Two slightly younger but equally disfigured wives were rocking children in their arms. One was breastfeeding. Seated before a weaver's loom was a young idol, magnificently dressed in silk, gold, and silver, knotting strands of wool. Leaving this gloomy den, realm of imminence, womb and tomb, in the corridor leading up toward the light, I met the male, dressed in white, sparklingly clean, smiling, sunny. He was returning from the market where he had bantered about world affairs with other men. He would spend a few hours in this retreat of his own, in the heart of this vast universe to which he belonged and from which he was not separated. For the old withered creatures, for the young bride doomed to the same degeneration, there was no other universe but the murky cave from which they would emerge, only at night, silent and veiled. The Jews of biblical times have more or less the same customs as the Arabs. The patriarchs are polygamous and can renounce their wives almost at whim. At the risk of harsh punishment, the young bride has to be delivered to her spouse as a virgin. In cases of adultery, she is stoned. She is confined to domestic labor, as the image of virtuous women demonstrates. She seeketh wool and flax. She riseth also while it is yet night. Her candle goeth not off at night. She eateth not the bread of idleness. Even chaste and industrious, she is impure and burdened with taboos. She cannot testify in court. Ecclesiastes treats her with the deepest disgust. And I find more bitter than death the woman, whose heart is snares and nets, and her hands as bands. One man among a thousand have I found, but a woman among all those have I not found. When her husband dies, custom and even law require her to marry a brother of the deceased. This custom, called leveret, is found among many Oriental peoples. In all regimes where woman is under guardianship, one of the problems is what to do with widows. The most radical solution is to sacrifice them on their husbands' tombs. But it is not true that even in India the law imposes such holocausts. The laws of Manu permit a wife to survive a husband. Spectacular suicides have never been more than an aristocratic fashion. It is far more frequent for the widow to be handed over to her husband's heirs. The leveret sometimes takes the form of polyandry. To avoid the ambiguities of widowhood, all the brothers in the family become the husbands of the woman, a custom that serves to preserve the clan against the possible infertility of the husband. According to a text of Caesar's, in Brittany, all the men of one family had a certain number of women in common. This form of radical patriarchy was not established everywhere. In Babylon, Hammurabi's code recognized certain rights of woman. She receives a share of the paternal inheritance, and when she marries, her father provides her with a dowry. In Persia, polygamy is customary. Woman is bound to absolute obedience to the husband her father chooses for her as soon as she is nubile. But she is more respected than among most Oriental peoples. Incest is not forbidden, and marriage takes place frequently among sisters and brothers. She is in charge of educating the children up to the age of 7 for boys and until marriage for girls. Woman can share in her husband's estate if the son proves himself unworthy. If she is a privileged wife, she is entrusted with the guardianship of minor children in the case of her husband's death and with the business management in the absence of an adult son. The rules of marriage clearly point out the importance posterity has for the head of a family. It is likely that there were 5 forms of marriage. 1. The woman married with the consent of her parents. She was then called the privileged wife. Her children belonged to her husband. 2. When the woman was an only child, her firstborn would be given up to her parents to replace their daughter. Then she would become a privileged wife. 3. If a man died unmarried, his family would take a woman from outside, give her a dowry, and marry her. She was called an adopted wife. Half of her children belonged to the deceased, and the other half to the living husband. 4. A widow without children who remarried was called a servant wife. She owed half of the children of her second marriage to her deceased husband. 5. The woman who married without the consent of her parents could not inherit from them until the oldest son, coming of age, would give her to his father as a privileged wife. If her husband died before, she was considered a minor and put under guardianship. The status of the adopted wife and the servant wife establishes the right of every man to be survived by descendants who are not necessarily connected by a blood relationship. This confirms what was said above. This relationship was, in a way, invented by man when he sought to annex for himself, beyond his finite life, immortality in this world and in the underworld. Note, this account is taken from Clément Houard, La Perse antique et la civilisation iranienne, Ancient Persia and Iranian Civilization. In Egypt, woman's condition was the most favorable. When goddess mothers married, they maintained their standing. Social and religious unity resides in the couple. Woman is an ally, a complement to man. Her magic is so unthreatening that even the fear of incest is overcome, and no differentiation is made between a sister and a spouse. Note, in some cases the brother had to marry his sister. She has the same rights as men, the same legal power. She inherits and she owns property. This uniquely fortunate situation is in no way haphazard. It stems from the fact that in ancient Egypt, the land belonged to the king and the higher castes of priests and warriors. For private individuals, landed property was only usufructuary. The land was inalienable. Property transmitted by inheritance had little value, and there was no problem about sharing it. Because of this absence of personal patrimony, woman maintained the dignity of a person. She married whom she wanted, and as a widow, she could remarry as she wished. The male practiced polygamy, but although all of his children were legitimate, he had only one real wife, the only one associated with religion and linked to him legally. The others were mere slaves, deprived of all rights. The chief wife did not change status by marrying. She remained mistress of her possessions and was free to engage in contracts. When the pharaoh Bokhoris established private property, woman's position was too strong to be dislodged. Bokhoris opened the era of contracts, and marriage itself became contractual. There were three types of contracts. One dealt with servile marriage. Woman became man's thing, but she could specify that he would not have a concubine other than her. Nonetheless, the legal spouse was considered equal to man, and all their property was held in common. The husband would often agree to pay her a sum of money in the case of divorce. Later, this custom led to a type of contract remarkably favorable to women. The husband agreed to absolve her of her debt. There were serious punishments for adultery, but divorce was fairly open for the two spouses. The presence of contracts soundly restrained polygamy. Women got possession of the wealth and transmitted it to their children, which brought about the creation of a plutocratic class. Ptolemy Philopater decreed that women could no longer alienate their property without marital authorization, which kept them as eternal minors. But even in times when they had a privileged status, unique in the ancient world, they were not socially equal to men. Taking part in religion and government, they could have the role of regent, but the pharaoh was male. Priests and warriors were males. Woman's role in public life was a secondary one, and in private life, fidelity was required of her without reciprocity. The customs of the Greeks are very similar to Oriental ones, yet they do not practice polygamy. No one knows exactly why. Maintaining a harem always entails heavy costs. Only the ostentatious Solomon, the sultans from the Thousand and One Nights, kings, chiefs, or rich property owners could afford the luxury of a vast seraglio. An ordinary man had to be satisfied with three or four women. A peasant rarely possessed more than two. Besides, except in Egypt, where there was no specific landed property, the concern for preserving the patrimony intact led to granting the oldest son special rights on paternal inheritance. From this stemmed a hierarchy among women. The mother of the principal heir invested with dignity far superior to that of his other wives. If the wife herself has property of her own, or if she is dowered, she is considered a person by her husband. He is joined to her by both a religious and an exclusive bond. From there on, the custom that only recognizes one wife was undoubtedly established. But the reality was that the Greek citizen continued to be comfortably polygamous, since he could find the satisfaction of his desires from street prostitutes or Genesium servants. We have Hetairas for spiritual pleasures, says Demosthenes, concubines, Polakis, for sensual pleasure, and wives to give us sons. The Polakis replaced the wife in the master's bed if she was ill, indisposed, pregnant, or recovering from childbirth, so there was no great difference between a Genesium and a harem. In Athens, the wife is shut up in her quarters, held by law under severe constraint, and watched over by special magistrates. She spends her whole life as a minor. She is under the control of her guardian, either her father or her husband or her husband's heir, or by default, the state, represented by public officials. Here are her masters, and they use her like merchandise. The guardian's control extending over both her person and her property. The guardian can transmit her rights as he wishes. The father gives his daughter up for adoption or in marriage. The husband can repudiate his wife and hand her over to another husband. But Greek law assures woman of a dowry used to support her and that must be restored in full to her if the marriage is dissolved. The law also authorizes the woman to file for divorce in certain rare cases, but these are the only guarantees that society grants. Of course, all inheritance is bequeathed to the male children, and the dowry is considered not acquired property, but a kind of duty imposed on the guardian. However, thanks to this dowry custom, the widow no longer passes for a hereditary possession in the hands of her husband's heirs. She returns to her family's guardianship. One of the problems arising from societies based on agnation is the fate of inheritance in the absence of any male descendants. The Greeks had instituted the custom of epiclerate. The female heir had to marry her oldest relative in the paternal family, genos. Thus, the property her father bequeathed to her would be transmitted to children belonging to the same group. And the estate remained the property of the paternal genos. The epicleres was not a female heir, but only a machine to procreate a male heir. This custom placed her entirely at man's mercy, as she was automatically handed over to the firstborn of her family's men, who most often turned out to be an old man. Since the cause of women's oppression is found in the resolve to perpetuate the family and keep the patrimony intact, if she escapes the family, she escapes this total dependence as well. If society rejects the family by denying private property, woman's condition improves considerably. Sparta, where community property prevailed, was the only city-state where the woman was treated almost as the equal of man. Girls were brought up like boys. The wife was not confined to her husband's household. He was only allowed furtive nocturnal visits, and his wife belonged to him so loosely that another man could claim a union with her in the name of eugenics. The very notion of adultery disappears when inheritance disappears. As all the children belonged to the city as a whole, women were not jealously enslaved to a master. Or it can be explained inversely, that possessing neither personal wealth nor individual ancestry, the citizen does not possess a woman either. Women underwent the burdens of maternity as men did war, but except for this civic duty, no restraints were put on their freedom. Along with the free women just discussed and slaves living within the genos, unconditionally owned by the family head, are the prostitutes found in Greece. Primitive people were familiar with hospitality prostitution, turning over a woman to a guest passing through, which undoubtedly had mystical explanations, and with sacred prostitution, intended for the common good by releasing the mysterious forces of fertility. These customs existed in classical antiquity. Herodotus reports that in the 5th century BC, every woman in Babylon had to give herself once in her life to a stranger in the temple of Mylitta for a coin she contributed to the temple's coffers. She then returned home to live in chastity. Religious prostitution has continued to our day among Egyptian Almas and Indian Bayadères, who make up respectable castes of musicians and dancers. But most often in Egypt, India, and Western Asia, sacred prostitution slipped into legal prostitution, the priestly class finding this trade profitable. There were venal prostitutes even among the Hebrews. In Greece, especially along the coast or on the islands where many foreigners stopped off, temples of young girls hospitable to strangers, as Pindar called them, could be found. The money they earned was intended for religious establishments, that is, for priests and, indirectly, for their maintenance. In reality, in a hypocritical way, sailors and travelers' sexual needs, in Corinth and other places, were exploited, and this was already venal prostitution. Solon was the one who turned this into an institution. He bought Asian slaves and shut them up in dicteriums, located in Athens near the Temple of Venus, not far from the port, under the management of Pornotropos, in charge of the financial administration of the establishment. Each girl received wages, and the net profit went to the state. After that, Kapaleia, private establishments, were opened. A red priapus served as their display sign. Soon, in addition to slaves, poor Greek women were taken in as residents. The dicteriums were considered so necessary that they were recognized as inviolable places of asylum. Nonetheless, courtesans were marked with infamy. They had no social rights, and their children were exempted from providing for them. They had to wear specific outfits made of multicolored cloth, decorated with flower bouquets, and their hair was dyed with saffron. Besides the women shut up in dicteriums, there were free courtesans, who could be placed in three categories. Dicteriads, much like today's registered prostitutes, aletrids, who were dancers and flute players, and hetairas, demi-mondaines who often came from Corinth having had official liaisons with high-ranking Greek men and who played the social role of modern-day worldly women. The first ones were found among freed women or lower-class Greek girls. Exploited by procurers, they led a pitiful life. The second type succeeded in getting rich thanks to their musical talent. The most famous of all was Lamia, mistress of Ptolemy of Egypt, then of his vanquisher, the king of Macedonia, Demetrius Polyarcides. As for the last category, many were well known for sharing in the glory of their lovers, disposing of themselves and their fortunes freely. Intelligent, cultivated, and artistic, they were treated like persons by the men who were captivated by their charms. And because they escaped from their families, because they lived on the margins of society, they also escaped men. They could seem to be their counterparts, almost their equals. In Aspasia, in Phryne, and in Laius, the superiority of the free woman asserted itself over the virtuous mother of a family. These brilliant exceptions aside, the Greek woman is reduced to semi-slavery. She does not even have the freedom to complain. Aspasia and the more passionate Sappho are barely able to make a few grievances heard. In Homer, there are remnants of the heroic period when women had some power. Still, the warriors roundly send them off to their chambers. The same scorn is found in Hesiod. He who confides in a woman confides in a thief. In the great classical period, woman is resolutely confined to the gynecium. The best woman is she of whom men speak the least, said Pericles. Plato, who proposed admitting a council of matrons to the Republic's administration and giving girls a liberal education, is an exception. He provoked Aristophanes' raillery. To a woman who questions him about public affairs, a husband responds in Lysistrata, "This is none of your business. Shut up, or you'll be beaten. Go back to your weaving." Aristotle expresses the common point of view in declaring that woman is woman because of a deficiency, that she must live closed up at home and obey man. The slave is entirely deprived of the freedom to deliberate. Woman does have it, but she is weak and powerless, he states. According to Xenophon, a woman and her spouse are complete strangers to each other. Are there people you communicate with less than your wife? There are not many. All that is required of a woman in Economicus is to be an attentive, prudent, economical housewife, busy as a bee, a model of organization. The modest status to which women are reduced does not keep the Greeks from being deeply misogynist. In the 7th century BC, Archilochus writes biting epigrams against women. Simonides of Amorgos says, "Women are the greatest evil God ever created. If they sometimes seem useful, they soon change into trouble for their masters." For Hiponax, there are but 2 days in life when your wife brings you joy, her wedding day and her funeral. But it is the Ionians who, in Miletus' stories, are the most spiteful. For example, the tale of the matron of Ephesus. Mostly women are attacked for being lazy, shrewish, or spendthrift. In fact, precisely the absence of the qualities demanded of them. There are many monsters on the earth and in the sea, but the greatest is still woman, wrote Menander. Woman is a pain that never goes away. When the institution of the dowry brought a certain importance to women, it was her arrogance that was deplored. This is one of Aristophanes, and notably Menander's, familiar themes. I married a witch with a dowry. I took her for her fields and her house, and that, O Apollo, is the worst of evils. Damn him who invented marriage, and then the second, the third, the fourth, and the rest who followed them. If you are poor and you marry a rich woman, you will be reduced to being both a slave and poor. The Greek woman was too closely controlled to be attacked for her conduct, and it was not the flesh in her that was vilified. It was more the responsibilities and duties of marriage that weighed on men. This leads to the supposition that in spite of her rigorous conditions, and although she had almost no recognized rights, she must have held an important place in the household and enjoyed some authority. Doomed to obedience, she could disobey. She could bombard her husband with tantrums, tears, nagging, and insults. Marriage, meant to enslave woman, was a ball and chain for the husband as well. In the character of Xanthippe is embodied all the grievances of the Greek citizen against the shrewish wife and the adversities of conjugal life. The conflict between family and state defines the history of the Roman woman. The Etruscans constituted a matrilineal filiation society, and it is probable that at the time of the monarchy, Rome still practiced exogamy, linked to a matriarchal regime. The Latin kings did not transmit power through heredity. What is certain is that after Tarquinius's death, patriarchy asserts itself. Agricultural property and the private estate, thus the family, become society's nucleus. Woman will be strictly subservient to the patrimony and thus to the family group. Laws deprive her of even those guarantees accorded to Greek women. She lives her life in powerlessness and servitude. She is, of course, excluded from public affairs and prohibited from any masculine office. She is a perpetual minor in civil life. She is not directly deprived of her paternal inheritance, but through circuitous means is kept from using it. She is put under the authority of a guardian. Guardianship was established in the interest of the guardians themselves, said Gaius, so that woman, of whom they are the presumptive heirs, could not rob them of their inheritance with a will, nor diminish the inheritance by alienations or debts. Woman's first guardian is her father. In his absence, paternal male relatives fulfill that function. When the woman marries, she passes into the hands of her husband. There are three types of marriage. The confarreatio, where the spouses offer a spelt cake to the Capitoline Jupiter in the presence of the flamen Dialis. The coemptio, a fictitious sale in which the plebeian father emancipated his daughter to her husband. And the usus, the result of a cohabitation of 1 year. All three were with Manu, meaning that the male spouse replaces the father or his male relatives. His wife is considered one of his daughters, and he thenceforth has complete power over her person and her property. But from the time of the Law of the Twelve Tables, because the Roman woman belonged to both paternal and conjugal clans, conflicts arose, giving rise to her legal emancipation. As a result, the Manu marriage dispossesses her male agnates. To defend the paternal relative's interests, sine manu marriage comes into being. In this case, the woman's property remains under the guardian's control, and the husband's rights are only over her person. And even this power is shared with the paterfamilias, who keeps his daughter under his absolute authority. The family court is in charge of settling disputes arising between father and husband. Such an institution gives the woman recourse from her father to her husband, or from her husband to her father. She is not one individual's thing. Moreover, although a gens is very powerful, as the existence of this court proves, independent of public courts, the father, as head of the family, is above all a citizen. His authority is unlimited. He rules absolutely over wife and children, but they are not his property. Rather, he administers their existence for the public good. The woman who brings his children into the world and whose domestic duties often extend to agricultural tasks is very useful to the country and deeply respected. Here is an important fact that recurs throughout history. Abstract rights cannot sufficiently define the concrete situation of woman. This situation depends in great part on the economic role she plays, and very often, abstract freedom and concrete powers vary inversely. Legally more enslaved than the Greek woman, the Roman is more deeply integrated in society. At home, she sits in the atrium, which is the center of the domicile. Rather than being relegated to the gynecium, it is she who presides over the slaves' work. She oversees the children's education, and her influence on them often extends to an advanced age. She shares her husband's work and his concerns. She is considered a co-owner of his property. The marriage formula, ubi tu Gaius, ego Gaia, is not an empty formula. Note, where you are Gaius, I am Gaia. Translation. The matron is called Domina. She is mistress of the home, associate in religion, not a slave, but man's companion. The tie that unites her to him is so sacred that in 5 centuries, not one divorce is recorded. She is not confined to her quarters. She is present at meals and celebrations. She goes to the theater. Men give her right of way on the street. Consuls and lictors stand aside for her. Legend accords her an eminent role in history. Those of the Sabine women, Lucretia and Virginia, are well known. Coriolanus yields to the supplications of his mother's and his wife's pleas. The law of Licinius, consecrating the triumph of Roman democracy, is said to have been inspired by his wife. Cornelia forges the soul of the Gracchi. Everywhere men govern women, said Cato.